talking here with Cliff Pontier. Cliff, any comments on the Seattle Sound and Citizen Dick's place in it?
Well, I don't like to reduce us just to, as being part of the Seattle Sound. I like to think of us expanding more. Like, we're huge in Europe right now. I mean, we've got records. A big record just broke in Belgium.
Several 20-somethings navigate single life in Seattle. This week, special guest Sue Winter from the Go Inform podcast joins us to discuss keeping your grandma's digits in your watch, the secret of the Seattle Sound, and what's so special about Bill Pullman's eyebrows. Then we find out if 1992's Singles stands the test of time.
It's the test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glut. Alan says as a father, blah, blah. It's the test of time. James and Alan have their say. Movies you love still hold up today. Test of time, James and Alan have to say. Movies you love still hold up today.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Test of Time podcast. My name is Alan Noah, and I have two people on my video screen today. First off, my co-host. How are you doing there, James?
Good. How are you, Al? Good to be here.
Oh, well, thank you. I am doing very well. And we've got a very special guest on the show tonight, Sue Winter, a.k.a. Maven, from the Go Informed podcast. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to have you here. I am a huge, huge fan of your show. Your podcast is amazing. But why don't you tell people what Go Informed is, in case they aren't already familiar?
Yeah, thanks. So Go Informed is a website and a podcast that I do to help people have a better vacation. The podcast is all about Disney World and Universal Orlando, tips to help you just have the best time ever when you visit. And on the website, you're also going to find information about tropical destinations like Hawaii and Bora Bora. So all kinds of fun stuff, and it's a hobby for me. It's a passion project, and really, I do it so I can talk about all my favorite things.
That's awesome. And how did you, like, get into that sort of thing? Like, were you always just a big Disney Universal fan?
I actually came to really know those parks as an adult, which is kind of funny. But my daughter was a teenager and we started traveling to the parks. And what happened is that I live really far away from Florida. I live in Seattle. So it was a real novelty that I had visited these parks, you know, like every year for many years in a row. So my friends kept asking me for advice and I got tired of writing the same email, you know, for like an hour and sending it. And I was like, I got to find a place where I can just write this once and send people a link. So that's how the blog got started. And then I've always been a big fan of podcasts. So a couple years ago, I started the podcast too. And then this past year, I've really, you know, gotten back to being pretty consistent with it since I find myself with a lot more time on my hands.
Right. That is life in the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I found your show a few years back when I was going to Universal Orlando with the family. And I didn't really know my way around. And I didn't know, like, where to go with the Harry Potter stuff. Mm-hmm. And there are not a lot of Universal podcasts. Like, there are a million of Disney World,
yeah,
but not a ton on Universal. And the ones that are out there, I don't want to disparage other people's work, but they're not great. And your podcast isn't just better than those. Your podcast is amazing.
Oh, you're so nice. Thanks.
No, it's really, really true. I felt like the whole time we were in Florida at Universal, all I was saying was, well, Maven said to do this, and Maven said we should go here, and Maven said this, and Maven said that. And everything you said was right. You led us, you know, to have a great vacation, and we were planning to go to Disney World in 2020. it didn't happen. But for whatever it's worth, I had like all of your hacks and tips and everything ready to go. Like I had a whole itinerary. There was a Google Doc situation. But then again, I was still saying, well, you know, Maven says we should go and have breakfast at the place in Norway, Akershus. Right. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
And that way we can be right there for the Frozen ride because my daughter loves Frozen. And so, you know, I feel like your podcast and your blog too. I've read your blog as well, but like it's very helpful and accessible and there's so much information, but you make it very easy to digest. And I highly, highly recommend it for anyone who's planning a trip. Definitely check out Go Informed.
Oh, thanks so much, Alan. Yeah, I mean, that's the idea. It's not a fan podcast. Like a lot of the Universal ones especially are like people who are annual pass holders and are geeking out on the little things. My whole thing is to help people who haven't been there before, or maybe it's been a long time, like first timers. So, you know, starting with like, how many theme parks are there? You know, that kind of stuff. And then diving deeper. So it's really cool to hear that, you know, that I helped somebody have a better trip.
Yes, you absolutely did. And I have recommended you even just like to friends when someone's like, oh, I'm going to check out that Harry Potter land. Like, okay, but you understand that the Harry Potter world is in two different parks at Universal. And you know what? You should just listen to Go Inform and you'll know all about it. It's really good stuff. And you had requested to do this movie because, as you said, you are a Seattle native, right?
Yeah. So thank you for indulging me and bringing me onto this episode because, I sent you an email a few months ago, I think. And I was like, if you ever do singles, please invite me on. I am a Seattle native and I am of the age that I was in my 20s when that movie was made. So there is a lot in there that's familiar to me from when I was that age. So it's always fun to watch that movie because I'm very nostalgic about it. So I will warn you guys not to rip it too far apart because there's a lot of stuff in there I'm nostalgic about.
That's okay. James, please go easy on the movie. You're always so mean and so harsh about everything.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, people don't really realize how central Seattle is to basically the last 20, 30 years of American culture, because the whole 90s Seattle grunge movement, not only was it music, but fashion. But in 1999, there was a huge protest in Seattle. Some people call it the Battle of Seattle against, I think it was against mostly the WHO.
WTO.
That would be the last administration was against the WHO. No, the WTO, the World Trade Organization. That was what first opened my eyes. I was like, Seattle was the birthplace of this. And, you know, Seattle doesn't get as much credit. You know, people talk about San Francisco as the birthplace of protests. And, you know, while it had its place in the 60s, really a lot of our lives are really shaped by what happened in this town in Seattle. Not only that, but Al, what is the greatest company in America based in Japan that is based near Seattle?
Oh, Nintendo.
That's correct. Correct. Nintendo and Microsoft and Intel is based near there, right?
Yeah, Intel's based near Portland. And of course, we have Amazon now, which has taken over our city.
Right. and Starbucks, right? Started in Seattle?
Yes, that's another one.
I went to Seattle a couple years ago to visit a friend of ours, a friend of our show, Mailer, that did The Shawshank Redemption. It's really a fascinating city. Like, the entire city is, like, built on top of an old city of Seattle. Like, you wouldn't think that America has these kind of things like you would in Rome. But you can really go to Seattle, and you could go underground, and you'll see the remnants of, like, Gold Rush saloons. It's a really fascinating city. I really recommend people visit it.
For sure. And you know, one thing that I really appreciate about this movie is that it really was filmed in Seattle. A lot of movies that are set in Seattle are actually filmed in Vancouver, BC. So it's not even Seattle. This everything about this movie is filmed on location, which I'll point out in a few spots as we go through.
To be fair, a lot of movies that seem to be shot in New York are shot in Vancouver. Like, Vancouver seems to be every single city.
Yeah, I
like,
think
I believe that Jackie Chan film, Rumble in the Bronx, you can see snow-capped mountains in the background. There are no snowy mountains in the Bronx.
But James, why don't you give us like a little recap of the movie for people who haven't seen it or don't really remember the movie all that well?
Sure. This film, it's from director Cameron Crowe. People know from Say Anything and Jerry Maguire, Almost Famous. And this is his film about Seattle. It's about a group of 20-something singles set against the backdrop of the early Seattle grunge scene. And there's a woman, Linda. She falls for Louise. But he's not who he says he is. Then Linda meets Steve, and they do hit it off. But Steve plays games with her. And there's Janet. She's obsessed with Cliff, but Cliff doesn't really care about her. Well, Linda gets pregnant, Steve proposes, Linda loses the baby, and then she and Steve break up. Janet dumps Cliff, and he begs for her to take him back. Linda and Steve eventually get back together. Oh, and there's also a couple other friends, including Debbie. She's desperate to meet a man, any man, really by any means necessary. You got that, everyone?
Right. Very simple. Very easy to keep track of.
You know, it's one of these ensemble films where there's a bunch of storylines going on that are all connected. And pretty much they're connected because most of these singles revolve around a single apartment complex.
Right. And this movie came out in 1992. How did it do at the box office?
It did okay. This movie was modestly budgeted. It had a $9 million budget, and it opened at number 3 with $3.5 million. And the number 1 film that weekend, that was another ensemble cast of a hacking movie. Do you know what movie I'm talking about? It actually starred River Phoenix as one of them.
Was it Hackers?
No, no, no. A movie called Sneakers. You ever heard of that film?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, Dan Aykroyd. We'll get to that film eventually. But this film opened at number 3. And you know, it opened with $3.5 million, eventually made $18.5 million. That's 5.5 times its opening weekend. So it was liked in the theaters. And I guess it made its money back. But it wasn't a smash hit at the time.
Sue, did you see it in the theater when it came out?
I was trying to remember. I'm not sure that I did. I'm pretty sure we rented it on VHS from Blockbuster.
As you did back in those days.
Right?
I own this on DVD. I haven't seen this in a long time, but I really like this film. It was one of my go-to films of when people came over and everyone's like, what do you want to watch? And this was a film a lot of people hadn't seen. And not everyone liked everything, but there was something that everyone would like in it.
What about the soundtrack? Did you guys have the soundtrack on CD or even cassette?
My brother had this, and I kind of, as a younger brother, idolized what my brother listened to. And this soundtrack is amazing. I guess probably one of the most famous songs is this song by Alice in Chains. It's called Wood. It's got Pearl Jam, it's got Smashing Pumpkins, Mother Love Bone. That was one of the really early grunge acts that inspired Pearl Jam and Nirvana. This is a huge soundtrack. It sold 2 million copies, double platinum. That's a lot for a soundtrack, especially from a film that was not itself a smash hit.
Yeah, I actually was reading a little bit about the film, and something I read said that they released the soundtrack before they even released the film, because the film was made at the time when these bands were just coming out. And when they made it, there was some controversy, you know, decisions about whether it was even going to be released. And then the music took off, and then they released the soundtrack, and they're like, yeah, release the movie.
Yeah, I had to do a double take of when this film came out because I realized if this film was released in September of 1992, it had to have been made in 1990, 1991, and these were not big bands. I mean, these are the hugest bands of the 1990s, but not yet, not at the time of the release. And a lot of these guys have cameos in there. Chris Cornell and Eddie Vedder. You see these guys in the movie, and you probably would not be able to get all these guys to be in a small little film a few years later.
Right. Cameron Crowe knows music. I mean, he famously wrote for Rolling Stone. So for him, getting Chris Cornell was a big deal because he just knew the scene, he knew the music. But Chris Cornell was not a household name in 1992, nor was Eddie Vedder. He was just putting guys in that he knew and he liked. And then, yeah, like a couple months later, it was all of a sudden, oh my God, Eddie Vedder is in this movie that's sitting on the shelf over at whatever studio. Like, we need to get this movie out in theaters now.
Right.
But let's get into the movie itself. And it starts with the character Linda, who's played by Kira Sedgwick. And she's talking to camera, which I was thinking about it just in terms of Spinal Tap, because we just watched This is Spinal Tap, and that's shot as a mockumentary. And I thought maybe that's what this movie was, but it's really not. It's just kind of like a device that they use to introduce the characters, and then once in a while they come back to it, but it's never really made clear who they're talking to, why they're talking to camera. It's just one of those quirks of the movie, I guess.
It's actually the same year that The Real World comes out. And it kind of, I remember thinking it was sort of that vibe. I looked up to see which one came out first. And The Real World, I believe that started in, was it Seattle the first year?
I think it might have been, now that you mention it.
And that started in 1992, probably just a coincidence. But I was thinking there was kind of a Real World vibe at first. The talking to the camera, it happens a couple times in this film, but it's not a huge part of it.
Right. And she's basically talking to the camera about love and being single. And then she gets into the story about Luis, who is quote unquote from Spain. They have this, I guess what you'd call today, a meet cute, and they fall in love and they're so happy. But then he has to go back to Spain because his visa is expiring. And Linda gives him her garage door opener. And that becomes like a recurring motif in the movie. And Sue, as a Seattle native, like, is parking like a really big problem in the city? Do people really prize their garage door openers?
Well, I would say in that neighborhood where these characters all live, which is our Capitol Hill neighborhood, parking is a big issue and always has been, because I lived in that neighborhood then too. And if you didn't have a parking spot, you could spend a lot of time driving around looking for one. So actually, it is kind of a thing.
Okay. And I mean, you know, it becomes like this symbol of commitment. You know, I think one of like the cliches from at least sitcoms is always like the toothbrush, you know, like the relationship is serious if you leave the toothbrush in your boyfriend, girlfriend, significant other's apartment. But in this movie, it's all about the garage door opener, the clicker.
Yeah.
And then we meet Steve, who also is talking to camera, and he has like his own thoughts about love and relationships. And he's talking about like when he was a little kid and how his pediatrician taught him about sex. And that's a pretty funny scene. His job is that he's working on a super train. What he wants to do in Seattle to alleviate traffic is come up with this big mass transit system. And from what I've read today, Seattle didn't have a mass transit system then, but they do have one now. Is that right?
You guys from the East Coast would not say we have a mass transit system. We finally have something many, many years later. I wish we had that super train that he was working on, though. That sounds really fun.
Yeah, because it's not just like a train. It's also about like with good music and good drinks, he says, right?
Good cup of coffee.
Okay. All right.
And, you know, that's a modern thing. This whole going into a coffee shop, a Starbucks, and I'll get a half calf with mocha and almond milk. This was not a thing that you did in 1992.
Not where you lived.
Exactly. Maybe in Seattle you did that. But in the East Coast, you could go to Dunkin' Donuts and you can get a coffee. Maybe you can get French vanilla coffee. And that was the fancy thing you could do. But it's something that sounds like, oh, it's run of the mill. But that was a Seattle thing.
The coffee thing that you see in this movie, that is the real deal. So I know we're going to talk a little more about how the coffee shop plays a role here, but that is exactly what coffee shops look like in Seattle in 1990. And people worked in coffee shops. A lot of young people worked in these coffee shops. And this is my personal theory about why our bands were able to do what they did, is because those guys either worked, their day job was as a barista at a coffee stand or a bike messenger, which also you see later in the movie. But the coffee culture that rose in Seattle at that time, it was literally the day jobs for these guys. So yeah, that coffee shop, it's not actually an actual coffee shop that existed, but it looks exactly like they were.
That's really interesting. I read something about how like the music scene in LA was like the guys who were in these bands, like these up and coming bands, that was their lives. That was all they did. Maybe if they were lucky, they'd have a girlfriend who had like a quote unquote real job that paid the bills. The guys, all they cared about was the music. But in Seattle, exactly like you're saying, they were hustling. They had a day job and then they went out at night and, you know, played in these clubs or whatever. And it was just a very different like mentality, work ethic. And, you know, that was the sound that broke through at that time.
And I wonder if the fact that these musicians in Seattle are being hyped up on caffeine all day, I wonder if that changes the music scene at all, as opposed to LA in 1990.
Well, if you hear that Soundgarden song especially, you will sense that there's a lot of caffeine fueling it.
Yeah, and that grunge, that kind of Chris Cornell kind of character, that's played by Matt Dillon. He plays Cliff Ponsler, and he's a guitar player for a band. I love the name of this band. It's called Citizen Dick, and he's dating Janet, who's played by Bridget Fonda. One of the first things she talks about is she talks about how old 23 is. And yeah, I guess kind of depressing there.
Yeah, that's just like, shut up. But I love when she says that her boyfriend is in this band called Citizen Dick and he's a real Renaissance man. That made me laugh out loud, because first off, the band is called Citizen Dick, but then like when you see him, he's just such like a rock and roll loser, basically, you know? He's just like such a dumbass.
I think he is hysterical in this film. Yeah. I think I laughed every time I just looked at him. He's kind of innocent, but stupid, but also kind of lovable, but lovably stupid and innocent. And I just got a kick out of him. And that guy, Luis, oh no, he has to go back to Spain and his visa runs out. Linda goes out with her friend that night and she just goes to one of the bars talking about this wonderful guy. Oh, I may marry him. And who does she see at the bar? Luis, who probably wasn't even from Spain. His accent was probably fake. He was just using it as a pickup to sleep with this woman. And Linda's, she's pretty pissed off.
And she then bumps into Steve at this club, and Steve's whole thing is that, like, I'm just going to come over and not have an act and just talk to you and be myself. But Linda's like, no, your act is saying you don't have an act. And it embodies this whole, like, single thing, you know, like how to be single. What do you do? What do you say? How do you say it? And it's really a lot of like these games, these tricks, even saying that you don't have an angle is in fact an angle. And, you know, of course, this is pre-Tinder and Match and Bumble and all of those things. And the way people met people was to go out to bars and clubs where you'd hear live music.
Yeah, that's where we all went. We all went out to see the bands. I mean, that was what you did. Although I'd have to say it'd be really hard to have a conversation in any of these clubs. There's zero chance if Alice in Chains is on stage that you're going to hear anything that guy said. So that part is unrealistic.
Oh, yeah. Well, that still holds up today. I mean, you go to a club, you're still not going to be able to hear anything.
True.
I do love, there's one piece of technology that is definitely outdated, but I had this piece of technology. Al, did you have that watch that that Steve's friend Bailey has? It's one of those Casio watches that was not just the calculator watch, but it was the one they called the data bank, meaning it could hold a couple telephone numbers in it as well.
No, I definitely did not. I mean, first off, in 1992, I was 13, so I was getting zero phone numbers from anyone ever. But like in the later 90s, when I was trying to get phone numbers, I would just have a pen and write them down. I did not have a watch. Were you using that watch to get digits, James?
No, it literally had like my best friend's telephone numbers in it, like probably my grandma's number. That's what I used it for.
That's adorable. Yeah.
I remember those watches too because they were a watch size. So the little buttons that you had to push were so tiny. I don't know how you could ever type anything in there.
I mean, you did what you had to do, but it was high tech back then. And no, it was not cool back then. It was definitely not cool. There is a nice little cameo in the club scene. Director Cameron Crowe, he plays the interviewer and he's interviewing Cliff from Citizen Dick. And if you don't make it in America, it seems like you can always be huge in Europe or Japan. That was what we talked about in This is Spinal Tap,
right?
That they were kind of a flop here in Europe, but Japan loved them. And he kept talking about how Citizen Dick is huge in Belgium.
It's funny in and of itself, but also like if you are in this burgeoning music scene in a city that is known for the music that they're creating, you don't want to be big in Belgium. You want to be big in your hometown. Like, that's the whole thing. That's the whole point.
I love that character of Cliff. Matt Dillon just embodied the grunge guy. You know, there's a lot of cameos in here, but I think they were kind of hanging out together a little. And, you know, the song that he's talking about, Touch Me, I'm Dick, you know, that they just changed the name of a Mudhoney song that's called Touch Me, I'm Sick. And that is a classic grunge song. It's sort of a deep track. Mudhoney never exploded onto the scene the way some of the other bands did. But yeah, so they took that song and they just changed it to Touch Me, I'm Dick. And then they named the band Citizen Dick. It's hysterical.
Yeah, there are some like deep references in here. At one point, Steve is wearing a Sub Pop Records shirt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're the indie label that first signed Mudhoney and Nirvana and Soundgarden. But also, again, like, remember that Cameron Crowe is making this before all of these things blew up. So,
yeah,
like, these are kind of like in-jokes for a very small percentage of the population, but if you get it, it's just that much funnier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One character we haven't really talked about yet, another woman that lives in this complex with all the characters we met so far, it's a woman, Debbie Hunt. She wants to be in a relationship more than anyone, and she has tried everything. And Al, you mentioned there was no Tinder or websites to meet people, but back in the day, there used to be what were called personal ads, like in the newspaper, and people would just write, single white female, blah, 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 you know, divorced male, blah, blah, blah. And I guess you'd call it the modern, you know, modern being 1992, the modern version of this was not a singles ad in the newspaper, but this was a video ad in which you would go to some little lame little studio, and you would record a little, like, 2-3 minute video, and then you would get a VHS full of, like, I guess probably a dozen little 2-minute snippets of whatever you were desiring, single guys, single women. And the video that she makes, it's not just her talking to the camera. It's from this, I guess you could call it an avant-garde director, who the worker at the video date place says he's the next Martin Scorsese, which is a great line.
Well, you know who the next Martin Scorsese is, right? Did you catch that cameo?
No, I didn't. Who is it?
That's Tim Burton. That is director Tim Burton.
It is?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And I mean, like, he's on camera for all of 15 seconds, but, you know, he's got, like, the crazy hair and everything. Cameron Crowe knew him, and Tim Burton did it as a favor. But just while we're on the topic of Debbie, like, is she a punchline? Like, are you supposed to just laugh at her? Because I thought that she was there primarily for comic relief. But I don't know. I wanted to get your guys' take on that.
She seems a little needy and sad to me. I've always been a little conflicted about that character. I mean, she is kind of cartoonish.
Yeah.
And some of her little scenes can be really pretty great. But you still kind of feel like, is she just desperate?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think she's the least fleshed out character in this film. Yeah. We don't really know why she's single. Like, she just wants to find a man. But we don't really find out that she's been screwed over or anything about her. So we don't really know much about Debbie. But I agree. I think she's probably a little more sad than the other characters who, you know, love doesn't necessarily work out for them. But, you know, you kind of are like, oh, okay, it'll work out for you, Janet. You'll get there, Linda.
Right. That's a fair point. And so after Steve kind of fails at hitting on Linda at the club, they bump into each other at a newsstand, which at first I was like, well, that doesn't stand the test of time, but it does. There's still newsstands around. There's still a thing.
But really, are you going to a newsstand at like 2 o'clock in the morning after a show? I always thought that was sort of weird.
That's a good point. I guess like maybe to grab like a candy bar or a soda or something, maybe. I don't know. If there's not like a 7-Eleven open and it's 2 a.m., I don't know. They go back to Steve's place and she has a line that kind of made me laugh from a test of time perspective when she says, I miss albums. And she's talking about vinyl records because in 92, people had cassettes and CDs. But he really is a music aficionado and he was a DJ in college. So he has like a really impressive vinyl collection. Then they start talking about like their exes and their old relationships. And Linda says that her dream guy is a mix between Mel Gibson and Holden Caulfield. Definitely don't think that stands the test of time to imagine Mel Gibson as a dream guy. Maybe for some people, but post whatever year that DUI rant was, I think he's probably lost some of his sex appeal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, this is 1992. So there is one thing that hangs over this film a lot. And there is this idea of safe sex because you're just getting out of the 1980s, you know, the decade that brought HIV and AIDS. There's a funny flashback to when they're back in college, which you assume is sometime in the 80s. And there's this safe sex party where people are dancing around with condoms on their head. And it's kind of played for laughs. But I imagine that things like this were really happening because people were really scared about sexually transmitted diseases.
Well, she has a great line and she says she was looking forward to, you know, finally having her freedom and going off to college. And then she says, I was a semester too late. And it's like, yep, she just got there right after all the condoms came out. And that's exactly what happened at that late 80s. It just flipped, like people who had older siblings who had just had a great, crazy time in college. By the time, if you were a late 80s college student, you probably weren't living that same life.
I thought that like the conceit of the safe sex party where they're like handing out condoms, like, okay, sure, that's great, that's responsible. But it's also like get dressed up as your favorite, like, prophylactic or whatever. Like, how many are there that there's going to be like all of these different options that you can get dressed up as, you know?
It is pretty funny though, because this happened when I was in college. They would do, you know, these things, you know, it's kind of like the campus, whoever it is, safe sex people, and they would have an event like that. I mean, it's not that far-fetched. It seems ridiculous. I don't think anyone went to these things, but they tried.
Like, there's worse things in the world. It's just like, you know, like, get dressed up as your favorite prophylactic. I feel like I would just be like, you know, what are my options and how do I get dressed up? But ultimately, Steve and Linda, they sleep together, and then there's all of these conversations. A lot of them take place in the coffee shop, like you're saying, Sue. That's where, you know, these conversations are held about, like, what to do and how long should he wait to call. And it definitely brought to mind Swingers, which is a movie that I've seen a million times, like the Vince Vaughn advice of, like, well, you got to wait 6 days or 8 days or, you know, definitely 10 days. And in this movie, he's sort of being pushed and pulled, you know, just call her. No, you can't call her. And Debbie is saying, this girl wants drama and she wants adventure. And then it cuts back to Linda, who's saying, I don't want drama. I don't want adventure. I just want someone who will call. He ends up waiting 4 days to call, which to him isn't that bad and isn't playing a game. But it is sort of like what Linda was saying earlier, where his game of not playing a game is in and of itself a game, and she doesn't appreciate that. And, you know, she's right to be pissed. Like, 4 days after they had this great connection and this great date, it's stupid. It's stupid for him to wait.
Oh, this definitely holds up today. I guess they'd switch it to texting or whatever, but how long do you wait? And can you send just an emoji? Does that count? Or, you know, this stuff definitely holds up, I think. And no one really knows the answer to it yet, but, you know, probably it's just if you both like each other. Probably not 5 hours later, like in Singles, in Swingers, but somewhere in the middle to let them know you're not playing games, but also that you're not too desperate.
Speaking of desperate, Janet, who is just head over heels in love with Cliff, she is talking to him and she asks if her breasts are too small. And Cliff says, sometimes?
I love that answer.
I mean, like, you can hear the question mark in his voice as he says it. And then Janet goes to see a plastic surgeon because she's going to have a boob job. She's going to have an augmentation. And the doctor is Bill Pullman. It's always great to see him. But, like, it's realistic because I feel like everybody knows somebody who's been in a relationship, or we've been in a relationship like that, where you want to do anything to please this person. And it's like, why do you care that much about pleasing this guy, the guy from Citizen Dick? Like, who cares what he thinks about your boobs? Like, it doesn't matter. This guy is the worst.
All I'll say is that I have seen the way musicians seem to have this magical ability to draw in people. And you're absolutely right. Janet seems so much better than Cliff, and she could do so much better, but she is just infatuated with him. You know, to the fact that she wants to change her body. And Bill Pullman's a plastic surgeon. He himself, he's having trouble finding women as well.
Yeah, he hits on her and says that, like, she shouldn't have the surgery. And she says that he has very trustworthy eyebrows, which just kind of made me laugh. Like, I don't think of Bill Pullman as a guy with, like, notable eyebrows. You know, like, what's so special about Bill Pullman's eyebrows?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that line was written specifically for Bill Pullman, or it was, they were like, for the character of this doctor, he has to have enchanting eyebrows. But I mean, I don't know what plastic surgeons do specifically today with this, but I assume that there's some kind of software that will show a picture of you and can show you with a thinner waist and bigger lips and, you know, maybe a bigger butt, smaller butt, whatever. And he's just showing a picture of, like, a torso. That's just kind of like a Barbie torso with bigger or smaller breasts. And there's really no reason he can't have, like, five pieces of paper that are like, this is your A cup, B cup, C cup, D cup, and larger than that. But they're just, like, playing around with this software. And you could tell that at the time this was really cutting edge, but it does not show Janet with large breasts. It just shows, like, this is what large breasts look like. And I just thought that was interesting.
I think it's funny that she's standing next to him and she's hitting the keyboard too. Like, that seems a little strange.
Well, I mean, the doc, he's trying to say she doesn't really need the boob job, but, you know, he's saying if you do want to get it, you could go up a little bit. But she's like, no, I want to be enormous. And his line, he goes, Janet, let me ask you, do you jog? Yeah, it's just something that a woman like Janet probably wouldn't think about before she gets breast enhancement.
Exactly.
I do have to say, though, that both doctors we see in this film, totally inappropriate the way they're acting to their patients. I mean, the way that pediatrician talks about sex and the way that, the plastic surgeon's like, you don't need the breast. You're beautiful. Why don't we hang out sometime? And I don't think that either of those things are appropriate. But in the end, she kind of gives him a little makeover with his hair and is like, hey, doc, you're kind of fun. You can meet a woman. And he's like, really?
Yeah, I would have liked to see his character just show up at one of the concerts later in the show, just sort of like in the crowd. You know, I always wanted to see him sort of hanging out with these people a little bit.
I thought they were setting it up that she was going to get together with him, that like mm-hmm. that was where her arc was going to go, that ultimately Janet was going to end up with the doctor, because he seems like a decent guy. I mean, mm-hmm. James, to your point, yes, he is acting inappropriately with a patient. Absolutely. But he's a good guy. And when Janet is talking with Steve before, because they're friends, she's talking about like what she wanted from a dream guy. And they were going to have common interests, but not exactly the same. And he was going to be this and be that and all of these things. And he would say, bless you when she sneezes. But after being single for not that long, like a year or two, she like lowered her standards so much that all she wants is someone who will say, bless you when she sneezes. And then later there's a moment where she's with Cliff and she does a fake sneeze. And then all Cliff can say is, don't get me sick because I have a gig.
Well, remember, Al, she is 23. She's really old. She has to meet a guy.
Right. I mean, like, it's insane. And I just like, I felt bad for Janet that she's lowered her standards so much. And this guy still doesn't meet the standards of just saying bless you, which is, you know, like fairly basic. At that point, she walks out. It does make me think. I shared an office once with a guy. He was an atheist and he like really held to that. And he's like, I will never say bless you when anyone sneezes because that's stupid and I don't believe in God. So I'm not going to say God bless you. And I was like, okay, sure. But then like anytime I would sneeze and it was just silence, it's just like, dude, you're the only person in the room. Like, shouldn't you say something? And I guess it is like a weird tradition, like when you think about it. But it is weird when you sneeze and no one says anything.
That's why in Seinfeld, his response would be, let's just say you're so good looking every time someone sneezes. So you're so good looking, Al, and you are.
Oh, why, thank you.
You're welcome, Al. So Linda and Steve, she was mad at him from the not calling for a few days, and they wind up getting back together. And the two of them, you could tell that the spark is still there, and they do like each other. They're going on dates, and then she says that she is late. And what she's meaning, of course, is that she thinks she might be pregnant. So this is a very test of time thing. This was, you know, it's very modern that that a woman was able to do a home pregnancy test. But what I didn't realize was how complicated these home pregnancy tests were. It's an entire chemistry set. You have to add sample A to sample B, wait 5 minutes, then add test tube 3 to test tube 4. And there's a great part where they're like, oh, if it turns blue, then you're pregnant. And, you know, they add it and we can see that it's so complicated. And they're like, is it blue? I don't know. Maybe it is. Let's put it against something white. But then when the camera pans away, this is like neon blue. It's not even close. It's like mega positive. But you could tell these two are kind of trying to give any excuse of, I don't know, maybe is it not blue and we don't have to have this talk?
I feel like we're lucky nowadays that you can just be like, you know, you pee on the stick and then it's plus or minus. Like it couldn't be easier. You know, to find out. I think they also said that it was like blue if you're pregnant and purple if you're not, if I'm remembering that right.
I think they've exaggerated it a bit for the movie. I mean, I think that it was more complicated back then, but probably not quite as complicated as they're making it out to be.
Well, that's good because, you know, you figure that like it could be stressful enough. She is pregnant and then he proposes and it's sweet. And, you know, she obviously thinks that he's proposing because she's pregnant and he kind of is. but he also really genuinely likes her and loves her. But then they're driving, and like whenever you're watching a movie and you don't see the characters in cars, and then for one scene they are in a car, that means they're going to get into an accident. I don't even think you'd call it foreshadowing. Like, it's just like a signal that like, uh-oh, something bad's going to happen. And it does. They get into this car accident. While they're in the hospital, she just like knows that she lost the baby. She kind of comes to and she's like, I lost the baby. Oh no, I lost the baby. Like, shouldn't like the doctor have told her that or something? You know, it just felt like, how would she know at that point that she lost the baby?
That's true. We also don't know how far in the pregnancy she really was. I mean, she could be several months pregnant at this point, but it's a devastating part in, you know, in anyone's life to lose a baby like this. But it's also interesting because you could tell that while she was not against having this baby, she was not super excited about being pregnant. And you realize, like, how can you love something that you never even met? And she's just absolutely devastated. And it takes a toll on the relationship, like you could totally imagine. And there was talk throughout the movie that she has this opportunity to go to Alaska for some kind of research, and she decides this is the perfect time. I need to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, and pre-cell phones, it's not easy to just kind of like text the whole time. Like, she's going to be on a boat off of Alaska somewhere. They're not going to be communicating for a month. And it's sad because you're kind of like rooting for this couple. And then we see more of Steve with his work and the train, and he's pitching it to people in the mayor's office, and the mayor's office people like it, but then the mayor doesn't like it and shoots the idea down. I felt like that was not the most compelling storyline, you know, just like his work in the train. I mean, I get it. We're supposed to see him diving into his work and, you know, he gets a rejection there too. But I wasn't heartbroken about the train not happening, you know? Losing the baby is sad. Like, the train thing, eh.
I always thought it was an interesting thing for this, like, 25-year-old guy to be pitching. It's not like he has this dream to, come on, mayor, I just need a couple bucks. We're going to start a homeless shelter, and it'll really be a good idea to help this little neighborhood. No, he's basically like, I just need like $2 billion to build a mass transit system in a Northwest city. I do remember thinking like, of course this is going to be rejected. It's just some guy.
Yeah, I don't really understand what his job is. I mean, does he work for the city or the state or what? And how is he even in charge of this whole thing? Only seems to be by himself. I mean, I could never quite figure that one out.
That's a very good point. And then, like, I wasn't sure if he quits or he's fired after that. You know, he just kind of like, you know, knocks over like the wall in his cubicle and then kind of leaves the office. But yeah, I mean, then Linda comes back and they decide to be friends because I guess they'd spent too much time apart or something. I didn't really understand it. There's this line of like, oh, let's be friends. And he says, well, we'll be the first people to say it and really mean it, which is like, you know, a sweet thing to say. But also, isn't everyone in this movie like exes that are friends? Like, you know, like she's still friends with her ex-boyfriend from college.
True.
We find out that Janet and Steve used to be together.
That's right.
Although, to be fair, it seems like Janet and Steve were probably just hooking up a little bit and then decided not to pursue it. But this one's a little different because I don't buy it for a second when Steve says he wants to be friends with Linda. No, he wants to be with her. And it seems to me, at least, that he wants Linda a little bit more than Linda wants him. You know, when you say let's be friends, that's the way of we don't hate each other and we're not storming away, but we're not going to stay together. So let's be friends. You don't see this as becoming a BFF situation. It's kind of sad. And also at the same time, Janet, she's had enough of Cliff and she decides, you know, the hell with him. You know, he's not really treating her well and she breaks up with him, which of course makes Cliff realize that he really wanted Janet. And he's been trying all these ways to get back together with her. He's trying to leave her flowers. There's a funny scene where he tries to fix her car stereo, which apparently had been broken, and he fixes it and she's really impressed and he turns up the remote control and he plays the bass so loud that it shatters every window in her car.
Did you notice the cameo in that scene? There's a young guy headbanging to the music standing there, and that is a very young Chris Cornell. It's adorable.
Yeah, it's like the perfect guy to be headbanging. I don't know, maybe like if you could get Dave Grohl or someone like that. But yeah, Chris Cornell and Cameron Crowe were friends. And apparently Chris Cornell was supposed to be Cliff originally, but then he was too busy, you know, making music.
And also Eddie Vedder's in the film. He's one of the bandmates of Citizen Dick.
Well, all of the bandmates of Citizen Dick.
Yeah, the band is it's Stone Gossard, Jeff Ament, and Eddie Vedder. It's adorable. They have the scene where they're reading the review of the band Citizen Dick. And Matt Dillon's character is just like, I don't want to hear anything negative. And so then you see the guys silently reading, they like turn the page. And then they say, I knew it was ably backed up by Stone, Jeff, and Eddie.
It is kind of meta because, you know, those three guys are talented. They're three-fifths of Pearl Jam. What's wrong with that band? It's Cliff. Like, that's the problem.
Yeah, and we also kind of tie up Debbie's storyline because after her video, which is a ridiculous video that was made by this Tim Burton, Martin Scorsese, it's a great video of her flying through Seattle, which makes no sense. None of it makes any sense. It's just hysterical. But she receives a video cassette of like a dozen men, and everyone seems to think that she should go out with this nice-looking guy who talks all about his bicycle. And she kind of does a classic mistake, which is she's not into bicycles at all, but she decides, oh, in order to get this guy, I'm going to be a bicycle girl. And she decides to buy a bicycle and get like bicycle outfits and bicycle sneakers. And she's going to bicycle to their first date, but she goes to the wrong restaurant and she bikes all over the city and she's not good at biking. She's finally told that that the dating company, strangely, this better be out of date, but the dating company gave the bicycle guy her home address. Oh my God, that is creepy. I really hope that that never happens. But she goes home, and unfortunately for Debbie, it turns out that bicycle guy seems to be more interested in Debbie's roommate. So the roommate basically pays off Debbie for the rights to date bicycle guy. And so Debbie is totally, once again, desperate. And she decides, forget it. I'm just going to Mexico. I'm going to get out of here. And she goes to the airport and she has a great line where she goes to the ticket desk and she goes, can you please seat me next to a single guy? And I assume that the airline woman is not playing a mean trick on her, but just sees that there's a solo male in seat 3A. So she puts him in seat 3B. And the solo male turns out to be, well, he is a single guy, but he's basically like probably a bar mitzvah age boy. He's flying home to his dad, who I guess has joint custody with him. The dad lives in Mexico. And it turns out that this single dad sees Debbie and thinks she's wonderful. And there you go. Debbie meets a great guy.
Like, her whole storyline, it is a joke, but it is also, like you were saying before, Sue, like, it's sad, and you feel bad for her. Like, she goes so into, like, the biking thing, and she gets the ridiculous bicycle shorts to impress this guy. And this is a first date. Like she's doing this before she's even met the guy. It's sad, like, just how desperate she is to find somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a happy ending for her. Yeah, it's not quite fleshed out, but we never really see Debbie again. And we get back to Steve, who is now, he is single, he's totally depressed, and he's just lying in his apartment. And there's a line, you know, I wouldn't call it test of time, because I'll bet you when I first heard this line, I didn't think it was true, but certainly in pandemic society, he has this line where he tells Janet when she comes over to check in on him, "Do you realize that in today's modern society, there's almost no reason to leave the house?" Because he's got like delivery pizzas and probably watching cable TV or something. So it's interesting. I'm not quite sure in 1992 you didn't need to leave the house, because you didn't have Amazon, you didn't have grocery deliveries, but he's doing it, but not so well. He's not doing well at this point.
I mean, that's the life we're all living right now, right? I mean, you don't need to leave the house. And yeah, definitely when he said that, my ears perked up. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, yeah. Very true.
Yeah.
He had called Linda and like tried to get back together with her, but the problem was that the answering machine ate the tape. And that's a thing that happened in the 90s. I remember, you know, sometimes the machine just wouldn't work and the tape would be, you know, it would sound like Alvin and the Chipmunks and you didn't know who was leaving the message. And, you know, from a test of time perspective, it is a fairly big plot point here that if Linda had heard this message, maybe things would have gone differently. Maybe she would have gone back to him. But instead, she gets back together with Andy, who is her old college boyfriend. And then one day she just shows up at his apartment and she kind of repeats the line that he said earlier in the movie to her. "I was nowhere near your neighborhood, so I just wanted to come by." He says, "What took you so long?" And she says, "I was stuck in traffic," because that was his job, to fix the traffic problem. And then they're having sex and they're bumping into the garage door opener. So, you know, you see the garage door opening and closing. Ha ha, get it. It's a happy ending for them. I felt like it kind of went back and forth like a bunch of times there, like in only, I don't know, like 5-10 minutes of the movie, you know, like she gets back from Alaska and then they decide to be friends and then he calls her and like begs her to come back and then she gets back together with her ex-boyfriend and then they get back together again. Like that's a lot of stuff that happens in their relationship and it's literally like 5 or 10 minutes of the movie. Like they just kind of jam it in there at the end.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that this film, which is only like an hour and 39 minutes, I think, I have a feeling that the original screenplay for each of these stories, there was a lot more to each one of these characters. Mm-hmm. And eventually they cut things to kind of put it all together and have it, you know, all the storylines kind of intersect with each other. We don't quite know exactly why she gets back together with Steve. We know why she leaves Andy, because Andy's this safe, boring guy, because she's sitting with Andy and they're reading the newspaper. And even in 1992, you're like, these people are too young to be sitting around reading a newspaper. Mm-hmm. "Oh, can I have the business section? Oh, thanks." They don't really like each other. And Steve and Linda, they're back together. And now they've decided to move out. And you just have Cliff and Janet left.
Right. And she gets back together with him after she has told him that she's not getting back together with him and told him that she's happy and she's over him and she's moved on with her life, because then they're in the elevator together and she sneezes and he says, "Bless you." And that bummed me out when she started like making out with him and like, "Oh, that's the happy ending for these two." I was like, "No, he's such a loser." I think maybe I also just think Bridget Fonda is super adorable in this movie and like I don't want her with this loser Cliff. So maybe I was like a little too invested in that relationship or that character.
She is so cute, and her fashion that you see, she is the one that's the most like in the grunge fashion that's in the movie. And the things that she wears in that movie and the Doc Martens, I mean, my daughter wears that stuff now. That style actually has stood the test of time. So nice. I like her. And actually, I think Cliff is cute. So, I mean, that's no long-term relationship, but she can have some fun.
Oh, I totally had a crush on Bridget Fonda. She was in a number of films at this point. Mm. That La Femme Nikita remake, A Point of No Return. And then I think she was in Single White Female. I think she's in that film. Mm. She had her moment at this time in the 90s. And yeah, she's adorable in this film. Although I agree with you, Sue, I only see it now. Cliff, he's adorable too. And, you know, while I think that there's a good chance that Linda and Steve are together forever, I'm not convinced that in 2020 the characters of Cliff and Janet remain together.
Definitely not. She's going back to school. She's like doing her thing. But actually, for me, those two, their character arc is really the most fitting to the rest of the movie because the music plays such a big role and the culture around it in the movie. And those two seem the most connected to it. And their story is a little lighter, I think, than some of the other characters' stories. So I kind of like that they end up together, but it feels like it's just that needed to happen. And then they'll get on with their lives. But they're only 23. So have fun.
This is very true. But so we're at the end of the movie. And Sue, I got to ask you, what do you think about Singles, this movie that takes place in your hometown? Do you think it stands the test of time?
Yes, I would say overall, I think it stands the test of time. There is a lot of stuff in this movie that doesn't. The answering machine thing that just keeps going through the story. I mean, that doesn't happen now. And we didn't talk about the scene where Steve calls from the bar. He's in the phone booth. And he's leaving this message. First of all, there's a phone booth.
I love that scene.
And it looks like the bathroom. So there's this huge crowd outside and they're banging on the door as they want to get in the bathroom. And, you know, okay, there's no phone booths anymore. That had to have been a bad idea even then. But I swear that is based on a real bar in our downtown Seattle. But the idea of the crowd out there pounding on the door and all that, like, that would still happen today. But then the references to the Sonics, that's just sad. We don't have the Sonics anymore.
Right.
But the music, what it to that movie does for me really does encapsulate a moment in time, not just in Seattle history, but also what it's like to be in your 20s and get home from work and just get ready and go out to a show and meet your friends. And so I like that part of it. And I do think it stands the test of time.
All right. James, what do you think?
I think that there is a lot that holds up in this film. I think one thing that would really fix something of this film is if in the first opening shot of this film, instead of this being a quote-unquote modern film, had it just said on the bottom, Seattle, 1992. I think that would place this as a period film as opposed to a modern film. And that would solve a lot of the problems that are taking place here because, yeah, a lot of these things don't hold up. You could think of a dozen scenes that a lack of a cell phone from Debbie's missed date and, you know, she doesn't know where to go and the answering machines and getting the phone numbers and a calculator watch. Like, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't hold up here technologically. I'd say film-wise, there's a couple stories. Storylines that, like we've talked about, Debbie doesn't really, I think that this character, I wouldn't say she doesn't work, I just think she's incomplete, because I think that character is a totally valid character, but we don't know enough about her. I like all the other characters. I think I can find something in common with a lot of them. The train storyline, I agree with you. I didn't really get it back then, and I don't get it right now. It seems to be a little bit too much of a pipe dream of asking for this multi-billion dollar project that his entire career was based on this one pitch. That being said, I do like the ensemble storyline. Sometimes they don't work. I think that Matt Dillon's hysterical in it. Bridget Fonda is adorable in it. Keira Sedgwick, she is not as big a star as she should be. Every time I see her in something, she's very good in it. And there was never really a Keira Sedgwick starring film. And she's always been very good. And Cameron Crowe, he knows how to make a film. This is kind of peak Cameron Crowe. He's probably going to get one or two more smash hits with Jerry Maguire and Almost Famous before, you know, before maybe I guess you're at the peak Cameron Crowe era. So he's at the top of his game here. The music, I mean, it's amazing. And, you know, the Alice in Chains Wood, that song is still being played like every day on, I listen to 92.3 FM, quote unquote, modern rock, but it still plays that song. It's that timeless, I'd say. Some of the storylines aren't really that fleshed out, but it's an hour and 39 minute film. And I think for its flaws, the film does hold up. So I'm going to say yes, Singles does stand the test of time. What do you think, Al? We've got two yeses, and now we come to Al, a movie you haven't seen before, and Al's record with films he hasn't seen before. I don't know, Al's ideas. If it was good, I would have seen it already. So, Al, what do you think? Does this film stand the test of time?
Shut up, James. Just because you're right. You know, I there are a lot of phrases that are used in this movie that don't stand the test of time. When they're looking at the music review in the paper, Cliff says, "Oh, snap, we're in the paper." Like, he says, "Oh, snap," which is not a thing that people say. When Debbie is trying to find the bicycle guy, she like goes from the one restaurant to the other. At the second restaurant, the waitress is like, "Oh, that bicycle guy, he was hot." And then she like licks her finger and then touches it to nothing in the air, goes, "Tss," which was a thing that people used to do to indicate that something was hot. I think if you just did that now, people would look at you like you're crazy. When Steve is like having his nervous breakdown at the end and Janet comes over, she's like, "You're wigging." Which I was like, "Wait, he's what? He's wigging?" So, you know, these are just kind of silly slang phrases that were a thing in 1992 that are not anymore. I was reading today that Cameron Crowe said that Friends was kind of based on this movie. Either maybe they ripped it off or just kind of a spiritual successor. And I was thinking that, you know, like you've got these single people, they're in a city, a couple of them work in a coffee shop or they hang out in a coffee shop all the time. And it's a lot of conversations about being single and, you know, what do you do? And this happened on this date. Now what? Those kinds of conversations. And that's really the draw of Friends. And you can sort of see how this movie, whether or not Friends ripped this movie off or not, you can see that connection. Like, I think Cameron Crowe is right to, you know, have that thought. I did think that the pacing in this movie was weird. Like, as we were talking about it, we were kind of jumping back and forth between the stories, and that's what the movie does. But the main story of Steve and Linda, I feel like we lose that. There's like a, I don't know, maybe like a half an hour chunk in the middle where they're just gone. Or like, you know, you see them in the coffee scenes or whatever, but it's all about Janet and Cliff, and then, you know, some with Debbie, and then we have like a lot of Steve and Linda, and then nothing with these other people. And I felt like they didn't do a good job of like intercutting the stories. But the thing that I think bothered me the most about this movie is that it's so closely associated with this grunge scene, and the movie itself, like the main story of the movie, isn't grunge, you know? Like, does the movie have a point about being single? Does it have like a statement? Maybe not. And maybe that's okay. You know, maybe it's not like a movie that like has an idea, but you know, like early in the movie, I think Steve is saying like his dad said, you know, have fun, stay single. Like, I thought maybe that could be the theme of the movie, but no. And is it that fairy tale romances come true? Not really. Is it that being single is hard, but it's worth it? Not exactly. You know, and if it was a real grunge love story, the theme would be love is hard and love is pain and your heart gets stomped on and who cares? You know, like it would be something like dark and melancholy, and that would be okay. Like, you know, sure, a movie can have that point of view, but it's fairly like lighthearted. These characters are like hip and fun and nice, and, you know, it doesn't really feel very grunge other than, you know, the music and the soundtrack and everything else. There's sort of a disconnect there, I thought. And in part, that's not really the movie's fault. That's just because of the association of the movie. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I didn't really connect with a lot of these characters. And there is just enough of like the outdated stuff to bother me that I'm going to say it doesn't stand the test of time. You were right, James. I'm sorry, Sue.
You bring up an interesting point. I never thought about it till you mentioned it. This film could kind of take place in New York, LA, or Austin. I mean, it's not definitely a Seattle film. I mean, there's grunge music, but there could have been a grunge club in Austin, and this film could have been in Austin, Texas. And I was wondering, Sue, is Capitol Hill, is this one of these things where today, Capitol Hill, a cliff could not live in this complex, and it's like 3,000 a month?
Yeah, it probably would be 3,000 a month. The idea that these single people could live in any apartment in the city of Seattle and work in a coffee shop might have worked in 92, but could never work now. But if you went to Capitol Hill, you would still see Cliff up there. They find it, you know, these okay. guys just get roommates. They find a way and they live in their grandma's basement or whatever. I mean, that guy still lives up there. I see him right now. And in my neighborhood, too. Heck, I just saw Jeff Amon at the coffee shop a few months ago.
Whoa.
So Seattle is still that town. But I 100% agree with what you guys are saying about the storyline. I don't care very much about, especially about the main characters, Linda and Steve. This is why it's interesting to hear you guys' take on it, because for me, it's about the nostalgia of the time, the place. It's so filmed on location that, like, when Steve goes to the store to get the pregnancy test and they show the outside of that store, like, I know where that is, and the inside of it is an old Pay and Save drugstore that we used to have here in Seattle. So, like, for me, it's really about a moment in time. It's almost like looking at old pictures, and then the music, you know, brings it there. But really, the characters, yeah, they could have been anywhere. And so I don't think it stood the test of time at the time, some of it.
That's interesting.
But, I mean, you just can't pass up the opportunity to see Soundgarden playing in that club. I mean, I just want more of that.
Right. Fair point. And I always feel bad when, you know, we have a guest who loves the movie and then I'm kind of like, no, it doesn't stand the test of time. But I will say that I'm still glad that I watched it. And I think it's worth checking out just for, you know, the Seattle scene and hearing the music. And yeah, you could just like throw on the soundtrack, but hearing these songs like as part of the movie, it is great. And seeing like the goofy young Eddie Vedder sitting in the coffee shop,
right?
That's great. Watching Chris Cornell headbang on the street, like, that's phenomenal. So it's an enjoyable movie for all of those reasons. But, you know, sorry, I had to be the negative voice.
Someone has to.
And it's usually me. And Sue, before we say goodbye, where can people find you? Where can people find the Go Informed podcast?
Oh, thanks. Hey, thanks for having me on too, you guys. This was really fun.
Oh, of course. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah.
So you can find me on my website is goinformed.net. My podcast is called Go Informed. And I'm on Instagram and Facebook and all that. Just look for Go Informed Net. And yeah. Thanks again, you guys, for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. It was great having you on the show, Sue. You're awesome. Next week, we're going to talk about another movie that's sort of like another quintessential Gen X rom-com kind of movie, Reality Bites. Sue, will you come back for that episode too?
Well, I don't know. I mean, are we gonna disagree again?
Maybe. I've never seen that one. I don't know.
I've never seen Reality Bites either.
None of us have ever seen it then, because I don't think I've ever seen it either.
Wonderful. Then three fresh takes on early 90s film.
Cool.
We'll have the perspective of having just watched Singles, so maybe that will make us appreciate Singles more or not like Reality Bites. Who knows? Who knows how it will color our viewing of Reality Bites? But you will know, dear listener, when you tune in to that episode next week. We don't want you to miss that. We're on social media too. We're at Test of Time Pod, so after you follow, go inform. send us a tweet, Instagram message too. And I'm looking forward to talking with you again next week.
Yeah, awesome.
Bye, everybody.
Take care.
Bye.